Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads. It's Derek, and we are back for another episode of the news. I am joined again as Danny is, I think, still kneeling outside the Kremlin or prostrate, whatever he's doing, trying to get the sanctions lifted. I'm joined once again by Alex Jourdan of the Quincy Institute. Alex is the Deputy Communications Director. He's also the co-host of Always at War, the podcast he co-hosts with Courtney Rawlings. Alex, thanks for coming back again. I don't know when this is going to end. They're not going to take the sanctions off. I don't understand why he's still over there, but we're grateful for you being able to fill in.
Always happy to, until Danny is forgiven for his crimes.
Happy yes, to fill in. Exactly.
Let's get into it, Derek. I mean, I think probably the first most obvious sort of foreign policy related story or thing happening today. We're recording Thursday, September 11th, which would make this the 24th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, which killed around 3,000 Americans and also spurned America's post 9/11 wars, which killed some 4.5 million people. So
yes, our little war on terror is all grown up.
It truly is.
Can't even, I mean, it's been drinking for 3 years now. It's not even getting carded in bars anymore. It's a real milestone. And I thought maybe instead of doing news, we could just recount where we were on the day.
Of course.
Just spend a couple hours talking about all the events that we personally experienced. Because, of course, as I'm sure you know, Alex, 9/11, the worst thing that's ever happened to any country in human history. So,
yes, a singular human event.
Obviously demands our attention.
I know that
the
listeners would like my blow by blow of that day in my fourth grade classroom. I was changed.
See, I mean, this is where the age gap, because I was at work. So this is where the age gap comes in.
You were teaching my fourth grade class.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. We've known each other for so long.
You got a little bit teaching. Of background.
Yeah.
What were you doing for work?
I was working. I was doing economic development work, actually.
Oh, wow.
Things. It was a much different time in my life.
Right.
And in Pittsburgh, I was still in Pittsburgh, and we, heard the reports of a small plane had hit one of the towers, and then that turned into obviously something much bigger, and we were kind of shuffling around, watching TV all day until everybody decided it was time to go home.
Right. Well, the post 9/11 era continues. Trump just this past week, doing strikes justified.
It's going to continue in depth. We're never going to leave the post 9/11. We're always going to be in the post 9/11 era. And I think we'll talk actually maybe
a little
toward
later,
the end
maybe.
Here about a very post 9/11 story.
Lovely.
It's going to be good stuff.
All right. Well, let's get rolling here. There's a lot going in the news. I feel like you guys need to get Jake to do a new Cold War type song for like the Israeli aggression corner, which I'm going to take us into here. let's get it going. So Israel launched a bombardment on Doha, the capital of Qatar. What were they doing there?
Yeah, it's just adding to the list. I think they're checking them off. Like, I have a list. Like, I want to go see all 50 states, U.S. states, before I die, and so I check them off. The Israeli government wants to bomb every country in the Middle East before it runs out of time. So Qatar was on the list, certainly, and they did attack on Tuesday a meeting of senior Hamas political leaders in Doha. The casualty count stands at 6. I believe there were people certainly wounded in the attack. I don't know if any of them are serious enough that there's a chance that they may succumb, but 5 Hamas officials or personnel, none of the groups, at least according to Hamas, and they've had actually funerals at this point, so it would be a little late in the game for them to try and manufacture obfuscate this, but none of the group's senior leadership, who were the real target, it seems, of this strike. So Khalil al-Hayya, for example, who's the acting chair, at least, of Hamas's Politburo, none of those guys were killed, but a couple of lower officials, I think a couple of bodyguards or kind of bodymen to some of the senior people were killed, and one Qatari internal security officer, police officer, essentially, was also killed. We can get into the ramifications of this. The upshot is that Hamas leaders had gathered in Doha to discuss the most recent ceasefire proposal, and we can, I guess, talk about that, although it seems dead at this point under the circumstances. When the Israelis decided to attack, there's still a lot of questions about how long this operation was in the planning. The initial claim from the Israeli government was that it was a direct response to a shooting that had taken place in East Jerusalem the previous day that was claimed eventually by the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. There is virtually no way that's true. That's a horseshit explanation. And we've gotten other reporting that suggests that the Israelis have been planning something like this for months, if not longer. I mean, if you really want to take the long view, they've been treating Qatar as a safe space for Hamas political officials for years.
Sure.
Qatar began hosting Hamas in 2011, and the Israelis have always sort of suggested that they would not attack. Now they're saying they could do it again tomorrow.
Right.
Or anytime they feel like it. But
well, just really prior quick, to on the 2011 Tuesday, piece, that was like encouraged or signed off.
It was at US request,
right?
Like, okay. Hamas leaders were kicked out of Syria or fled Syria during the civil war after they picked, you know, what at the time seemed like the wrong side, not necessarily the wrong side anymore, but they threw in with some of the jihadist elements that were rebelling against Bashar al-Assad, and had to leave Syria. And it was the Obama administration that encouraged Qatar to take them in and set up a political office similar to the one that the Qataris had set up for the Afghan Taliban, because the U.S. saw utility in having a place where you could interact with these groups, even on an unofficial level, groups that the West doesn't talk to directly, but you could still have a conduit for speaking to their political leadership, at least. The Qataris have maintained this office basically at the behest of the U.S. and Israel. Israel has found it useful to have this office in Qatar as well. It's also relied on the Qataris to, for example, pay civil service salaries in Gaza to prevent that, you know, prior to all of the genocide, obviously, but to prevent that region from becoming a full-on economic black hole. They had been relying on the Qataris for that. And there's a lot of stuff here, and the Qataris have a lot of grievances that they've aired in the last couple of days,
right?
Over this. So yes, it was at U.S. behest. Nevertheless, we could argue that the Israelis have been playing a very long game here and kind of, keeping this in their back pocket, the idea that they would be willing to bomb Qatar to try and take out the senior leadership of this group.
Well, and you alluded to this a bit earlier, Derek, but talk to us about how this impacts, I guess, first, Qatar's status as the place that the U.S. talks to unsavory adversaries, but also the ceasefire talks, which were, you know, the reason for the season. That's why the Hamas officials were in Qatar in the first place.
Right. I mean, a lot of like in terms of Qatar's role or its relationship with the United States, which may be, you know, in question at this point, a lot of that's yet to be determined. The Qataris have expressed some public and some anonymous anger over the incident. They say they were not given notification by the Trump administration. The Trump administration's had, I think, three or four different stories at this point about when they found out from the Israelis that this was going to happen, or whether they even found out. There was one version of this tale that had the Israelis saying, hey, by the way, we're going to attack Hamas, and then, but they didn't say where. Right. So they left the U.S. in the dark about whether it was going to be in Qatar or not. But there's questions about the timing. Initially, the Trump administration claimed that it informed the Qataris ahead of time. The Qataris said, no, no. By the time we got your phone call, there were already explosions in Doha. So it was too late to do anything about it. There's questions about why the U.S. air defense assets at Al Udeid Air Base and didn't activate in response to the missile strikes from the Israelis. There's a lot of unanswered questions there that could impact on the U.S.-Qatar relationship and Qatar's role as a regional mediator. In terms of the ceasefire negotiations, I mean, I feel like they're dead at this point, and there's a real question even as to whether the most recent ceasefire proposal that the Trump administration forwarded to Hamas a few days before this attack took place was all just an elaborate scheme to get them to meet in Doha and make themselves vulnerable to an attack. What they gave to Hamas, and this was covered by DropSite, was so vacuous that there was really nothing there for Hamas to agree to. It was basically a 100-word document that said Hamas will release all of the remaining living and dead captives within 48 hours of a deal, and then we'll talk about all the rest of it. Like, there was no details, there was no obligation for Israel. It was all to be worked out, to be determined. And so, it was so vapid that you can ask legitimately whether it was a real proposal. Initially, my thought was they were doing this to elicit a rejection from Hamas, and then that would justify the Gaza City operation and the ethnic cleansing that's coming. I think it would be fair to ask whether there was a plan to get these guys all right to show up in Doha and take them out. So at this point, if you were Hamas, if you were a senior figure in Hamas, I don't think there's any reason why you should listen to another proposal, or certainly gather to discuss another proposal, because there's no reason to believe that you're not putting your life at risk at that point. Mm-hmm. From the Qatari perspective,
the carrot under the box and a loony.
Yeah, team. Exactly. Like, exactly. You know, you're being lured into a trap.
Yeah.
The Qatari position on in terms of mediation, they've been a little bit all over the map, and I can sort of understand why, because this is a somewhat shocking incident, and they're still trying to kind of calibrate a response to it. They've suggested, and most of the statements have come from the Qatari foreign ministry, or the Qatari prime minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, who have said that Qatar is always going to be willing to be a mediator, and it's going to try and end the carnage in Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't really see a way forward at this point. So I don't know how to interpret that other than to say that in principle they're still willing to play a role, but in practice they don't really see any point in continuing to mediate at this time. That could change. But that's where I think things stand.
You mentioned one potential reason for the term sheet being so shallow is that, it may be a pretext for, Israel's invasion of Gaza City. Could you speak a little bit more about what the IDF is doing there and what the leaders have been saying?
Yeah, the most recent major development was that the IDF started dropping leaflets. This was also on Tuesday, coincidentally or not, the same day that they struck Qatar. dropping leaflets on Gaza City, ordering the remaining people living there, which is still around 1 million people. There've been, I think, estimates of maybe 100,000 or 150,000 who have evacuated already, but ordering the rest of them to evacuate before the IDF moves in and just obliterates the area. In the last few days, starting late last week, they have begun destroying Gaza City's remaining high-rise residential buildings, most of them still sheltering people who have been, you know, given very short notice to get out of the buildings before they're destroyed and have, you know, tried to take as many belongings with them as they can, you know, fairly unsuccessfully, I would imagine. It does seem that they are intent on leveling this region, and of course driving the people who do leave south, and the people who don't leave will be taking their lives into their hands. There's still some delay in terms of the meat of this operation, and I think, you know, part of that is that they still want to allow time for people to evacuate. They also still need to mobilize these tens of thousands of reservists that the IDF has called up to participate in the operation, some of whom appear to be not so thrilled about getting called up again and have kind of balked at reporting for duty. So that may be an issue. So I think it's still going to be a week or two before you see the main thrust of the operation into Gaza City. But in the meantime, they have definitely escalated and are, you know, as I say, have issued this kind of blanket evacuation order.
Bad signs, bad signs. And speaking of bad signs and bad folks, we're seeing reports. I have not gotten a chance to read further into this. I'm very curious to get your breakdown. So the GHF, which is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, was hiring biker gangs as part of its security apparatus.
One particular biker gang. Yeah. So this is the result of a BBC investigation. I think it had already been revealed that one of the senior figures in a group called the Infidels Motorcycle Club was working for the GHF's security contractor, a company called UG Solutions in Gaza. What the BBC found is that at least 10 members of the motorcycle club are in Gaza. At least 7 of them are in what the BBC called senior positions, overseeing security at GHF distribution sites. The Infidels Motorcycle Club was founded by Iraq war veterans. It was founded, I think, in 2006. These are people who believe that they are fighting a modern crusade against Islam. They get crusader tattoos all over their body. They say and do horrifying anti-Muslim things. And needless to say, they should not be carrying weapons with live ammunition in them amid large crowds of Muslims in Gaza. And yet here we are. They've been contracted to do this work by this company, the UG Solutions, which says it doesn't discriminate in its hiring practices for personal hobbies or affiliations.
It sounds like they're
related to job performance.
It sounds like they're pro discrimination.
They don't discriminate for affiliations unrelated to job performance. I would argue that membership in an organization that believes it's at war with Islam and should kill Muslims, it is related to your job performance when you're supposed to be guarding an aid distribution site in a predominantly Muslim occupied territory. But you know, what do I know? I'm not obviously versed in the ways of big business and security contracting. Maybe I'm off base here, but that's basically what the report was. Really disturbing stuff that I think, you know, for all of the protestations about, you know, the GHF and its deep desire to feed and protect the hungry people of Gaza, this kind of stuff reveals what this whole scheme is really about.
Well said. Like, if this stuff's on the surface, what lies beneath? Nasty business. All right,
exactly.
Let's move on here to Ukraine war news. There was some serious headlines this week. Russian drones made an incursion over Polish airspace. NATO responded. There was invocation or talk of Article 4. What happened here, Derek? And what does it pretend for the war in Ukraine?
I don't think it pretends anything coming out of this incident specifically, but it does highlight the fact that the longer this conflict goes on, the more dangerous it becomes.
Sure.
As you said, on Wednesday, multiple Russian drones apparently entered Polish airspace. The Polish government counted, it said, 19 violations of Polish airspace. It scrambled its own aircraft as well as some NATO aircraft that were stationed in Poland to intercept these drones. They shot down at least three of them. This was according to Donald Tusk, the prime minister of Poland. It is not the first time that Russian ordnance has entered NATO airspace over the course of this war. It is the first time that one of these countries' militaries or NATO, to take it a step further, has deployed or engaged the ordnance and shot some of it down. The Russian government later denied that it had intentionally sent these things into Polish airspace. Of course, the Polish government is calling this a deliberate attack, and that the Russians are sort of testing NATO at this point. As you mentioned, the Polish government did invoke Article 4 of the North Atlantic Treaty. This is not Article 5. There's no obligation for member states to do anything, but Article 4 does allow any member to call convene a meeting of the full alliance, which they had. In Brussels, the ambassadors of the various NATO countries all got together. I think they were scheduled to have a meeting anyway on Wednesday, but they made the meeting about this Article 4 invocation by the Polish government. They didn't decide to take any serious action. But, as I say, I think the worry here is not so much this particular incident as, what's the next one going to look like, or what's the one after that going to look like, and how many times does this happen before you get to a point where somebody does something that leads to a much bigger war? And totally. Know, whether it's accidental, whether it's, on the scale of, lone gunman shoots the Archduke of Austria or
right,
something,
right.
More deliberate, who knows? But that is the risk that looms behind this entire conflict.
Well, it reminds me, in 2022, like, a Russian plane apparently accidentally shot at a British surveillance craft over the Black Sea and like nearly missed and would have killed like a dozen British airmen. And it's like, we're one of those away from being in a really serious crisis with a
nuclear-powered, this isn't even Russia. The most serious one of these. I would argue that the Russians, I forget what year it was, the Russians and Turks got into a thing over Syria.
Oh, yeah.
And a Turkish aircraft, I believe, was shot down.
That's right. Yeah.
And that to me was more serious even than this incident. Fortunately, it didn't go anywhere. I know there are some people in Europe who would like to forget that Turkey's a member of NATO, but it is. And so that could have invoked, all sorts of things. There was a lot of concern about that. But Syria, being at a distance from most of NATO, I think was less of a risk of a tripwire than Ukraine.
Sure.
So this is, as I said, just a troubling indicator of where things could go.
Troubling indeed. Okay. Check this transition from nuclear war to nuclear deal. Iran and the IAEA.
Nice.
You can't hear Derek cringing, but he is. So Iran and the IAEA have reached a tentative deal around, is this around monitoring Iran's nuclear program? What's going on here?
Yeah, they announced this on Tuesday. It's very sketchy. Neither side has announced much in the way of detail about this. Rafael Grossi, the director of the IAEA, did say that the deal covers inspections at all of the relevant Iranian nuclear sites. But they announced, that they had come to an agreement, I think, in principle, to resume IAEA inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. The Iranian government had suspended its relationship with the IAEA after the so-called 12-day war. It blamed, in part, the IAEA for its alarmist interpretation of Iran's nuclear activities, arguing that that played a role in fomenting the conflict. As I say, they're light on details, and I suspect a lot of that still has to be worked out. But in principle, this is a positive development. It addresses one of the criticisms of the so-called E3, that's France, Germany, and the UK, who I believe we talked about this, invoked the snapback provisions of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal last month, and we're, you know, on a 30-day countdown. I mean, you know, we're well into it at this point. For UN sanctions to be reimposed on Iran because of that invocation, at which point the Iranians have said pretty much all bets are off. One of their demands, one of the E3's demands, when they impose snapback and for avoiding, you know, kind of cutting things off before the 30-day deadline, before the sanctions came back, was that Iran reinstate its relationship with the IAEA and that these inspections resume. So this addresses part of their concern, but the other stuff, including a resumption of nuclear negotiations with the United States, but between Iran and the United States, there doesn't seem to be any movement on, you know, in on those fronts. So I think we're still in a situation where you're going to see the sanctions reimposed, and the Iranians are going to react how they react. We'll wait and see. But they've threatened everything up to and including quitting the non-proliferation treaty, so that could be a very, very serious situation if it gets to that point.
Jeez. All right. Well, let's cross our fingers for good news from the Middle East, which is always what you should expect.
Yeah, it's always well. It's a good news kind of place. I mean,
especially with the U.S.'s productive engagement in the region.
Yeah.
We're making things better. Okay, let's talk about what's going on in Nepal. There were protests, resignations from the head of government. I saw video of, I think it was Kathmandu, like mass, like street protest or something. What
on fire.
Did you see
some of it on fire? Yeah. Right. So there's protests broke out several days ago over a government ban on social media sites. Meta, I think, was particularly targeted. I'm not sure the whole list of sites, but this has been called a Gen Z protest in part because the youth were upset that I guess the government was taking away their social media access. But it turned pretty quickly into a more general anti-corruption movement against the government. And this is in keeping with other recent protest movements that have expressed, you know, anger over, you know, corruption or perceived corruption. Some of them going as far as to call for a reinstatement of the Nepali monarchy, which was abolished about 20 years ago, I believe. You know, because they're just people just seem to be very dissatisfied with the politicians or the political class that has assumed control of the country since then. So yeah, it was a very large protest movement that broke out here, mostly young people. On Monday, these protests turned violent in especially Kathmandu, but also the city of Itahari. The situation in Kathmandu was, I guess, the protesters had attempted to enter the Nepali Parliament building. They were stopped by police and things got quite heated. At least 19 people were killed on Monday. At least 25, wow, I believe, is the latest total I've seen, were killed throughout these protests, but at least 19 of them in the biggest day on Monday. On Tuesday, the prime minister of Nepal, KP Sharma Oli, resigned. He was apparently asked, and this was after a couple of his ministers had resigned, one of them, I think, over the decision to impose the social media ban, and then others, you know, because of the violence and the death toll. Oli resigned, and I believe was asked by the president of Nepal, Ramchandra Paudel, to remain in office in a sort of caretaker capacity until he could settle on a new prime minister. But this was when the protesters actually did break in to the parliament building and attacked the prime minister's residence and a number of other official buildings in Kathmandu, setting fire to them and ransacking them. And Oli fled. I still don't think anybody knows where he is. So his whereabouts are unknown. As of Wednesday, the Nepali army, which does not typically get involved, it's not unheard of, but does not typically get involved in domestic law enforcement. But the Nepali army had deployed into the streets of the capital. There seemed to be things seemed to be much calmer, at least on the surface. Nepali military officials had met with protest organizers to discuss how to proceed from here. But there's still no prime minister effectively. I mean, you know, Oli is still, parts unknown. And so it seems like the army at this point is functioning as the de facto governing authority, in the country. And, you know, we'll see what transpires from that. The protest organizers do have a couple of people, I think, in mind for, stepping in as interim heads of government, but you know, this is all subject to negotiations between them and the army, which seems so far to be sort of open to discussion, but who knows how long that will last.
I know listeners know everybody hates when two of their homies are fighting. We got some positive news.
Yeah, Trump, mom and dad have been fighting again.
It's really tough on all of us. It's taking a toll, but history's greatest bromance. Maybe there's some opportunity here for rekindling. Trump suggested that he will speak to Indian leader Narendra Modi after there's been some falling out over Trump's high tariffs and India's use of Russian oil. What's the latest here?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, it's another one of his social media posts, which he made on Tuesday that, you know, you don't know what to, you know, how much credence to really give it. But Trump did say that he sort of declared out of the blue that he's going to speak with Narendra Modi at some point. He didn't say when. All he said, I think, was in the upcoming weeks, which could be anything. And then said that he doesn't think they'll have any difficulty coming to a trade agreement. As you noted, the U.S. has currently got a 50% tariff on Indian imports. Half of that is under the reciprocal tariff scheme. The other half is this penalty, ostensibly because of India's economic ties to Russia that have supposedly enraged Trump. So, and that in turn has caused quite a bit of frostiness in the U.S.-India relationship, as you might expect. Which has coincided with, and I don't think one is necessarily the result of the other, but it's coincided with some minor signs of improvement in the India-China relationship. So you've had people talking about, you know, a potential geopolitical shift in the so-called Indo-Pacific region. You know, if the U.S. is going to drop its alliance or its budding friendship with India, and India is going to take up with China or some dramatic shift. None of that has actually happened, but it's pushed things a little bit in that direction, I guess. Now you've got Trump saying that he's going to, you know, talk to Modi, and maybe he's having second thoughts about being so upset with India for whatever reason. I still don't think it has anything to do with Russia, but that's just me. So yeah, we'll see if this comes to pass. Again, it could just be something he blurted out on social media, but maybe it signals that this little spat is approaching an endpoint.
I mean, isn't there some sign that the genesis of this feud is over, like Modi disputing Trump's role
absolutely. I think that's what it is. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Trump is so petty, and you know, the Indian government just flat out said he didn't have anything to do with negotiating the end to that or mediating an end to that Kashmir conflict earlier this year. And I just think that's, you know, been bothering him ever since. It screws up his Nobel application. You know, it's what are you going to do? You're trying to take this man's peace prize away from him. You have to expect he's going to make you pay for that.
A despicable behavior. Well, this will be the first time that he's done something out of like venal or petty motivations.
It's not common for Trump, yeah. For Donald Trump. I agree, but like, everybody has their weak moments.
Yeah, of course. Even the best of us.
Yeah.
So let's turn to Japan here. There are cycling through prime ministers recently, it seems like, and we have yet another transition.
The next one could go maybe like 6 months instead of 8 months, and then you could just get it down to like a day by day thing. Ishiba Shigeru, the prime minister of Japan, resigned on Sunday. This was both a surprise and not a surprise. It's not a surprise because Ishiba has presided over some really heavy electoral losses for the Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner, the Kometo Party. They lost their majority, their collective majority in the House of Representatives shortly after he took office last October. They lost their majority in the House of Counselors, the upper house of the Japanese parliament, in July. So with that record, it seemed inevitable at the time of the House of Counselors election that Ishiba would resign. What makes it a little bit surprising is that he didn't resign in the immediate aftermath of that election. In fact, it sounded like he was had no plans to resign. He talked first about needing to get the U.S.-Japan trade deal finished before he could even consider stepping aside. But then he got that done and still showed no indication that he was going to resign. So for him to do it now is a little bit surprising, just timing-wise. That said, he was apparently going to be facing some internal challenges to his leadership from within the party, and I guess figured that his position was untenable, and so he decided to get out of the way and let everybody else duke it out. There's a number of people who have either already announced or are likely to announce that they're participating in the contest to replace him as the leader of the LDP and thus as the prime minister of Japan. The two favorites, from what I've seen, are a longtime LDP lawmaker named Takaichi Sanai. She was sort of the runner-up, or one of the runners-up. I think she finished. She was the second place finisher, but the sort of third place, if you want to put it that way, in last year's leadership election. She is thought at this point to be too far right. And given that the LDP doesn't have its majorities anymore, it's reliant on sort of ad hoc alliances with other more centrist parties to pass any legislation. She's thought to be a little bit too far right for that kind of thing. So that may hurt her. And a number of, I think, her allies in the party are no longer around to boost her candidacy. The other favorite that I've seen is the agriculture minister, Koizumi Shinjiro, who's kind of a younger, charismatic, apparently a little more centrist character. He seems like he might have the inside track, but you know, I'm certainly no expert on Japanese politics, so let's just put a pin in that and see what happens.
All right, let's stay in East Asia here. There was an ICE raid in my home state, Peach State of Georgia. I think at the Hyundai plant, saw some hundreds of South Korean workers rounded up. And like publicly arrested and put in handcuffs. This is like totally rocking the South Korean U.S. relationship. It seems like, I mean, the U.S. has pressed South Korea to invest, you know, in the U.S. and Hyundai is a premier brand like Kia in South Korea. And so there's some serious blowback, it seems, from this. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's Hyundai. The plant was Hyundai and LG, so two premium Korean brands. It was like an electric vehicle battery plant. So it was co-operated by those companies. And yeah, as you say, ICE raided this facility. It put hundreds of South Koreans in chains and like marched them past cameras into, you know, onto buses for detention. Which has been shocking, I think, to anybody who's seen those videos in South Korea.
It was like front page news in South Korea.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's been a major story in South Korea. A lot of questions about what this means for the South Korean relationship with the United States. At the heart of it seems to be a longstanding complaint by the South Korean government, and I imagine other governments as well, that the U.S. doesn't have a visa system that can accommodate short-term workers who come over when a country you know, opens a factory, or a foreign company opens a factory or a facility in the United States, who can come over and, like, you know, get that facility off the ground. They're not staying indefinitely. They're not working here indefinitely, but they do work for a certain period of time to kind of get things going and then leave. And the U.S. doesn't really seem to have a visa that is applicable to that specific situation. And so instead it relies on, you know, sort of stopgaps this with the what's known as the visa waiver program, which for, you know, countries that make it into that program, you get 90 days where your nationals are allowed to be in the United States without a visa before they have to leave. But, you know, you get situations where, you know, people overstay that 90-day window, or, you know, they come up on it and they still have to, you know, get something done, or they're not ready, you know, they can't leave yet for work reasons. And then it becomes a very complicated thing until you get the Trump administration in office and they simplify everything by just arresting all these people and throwing them into detention. And that, you know, that brings the what had been, you know, sort of an administrative or procedural complaint to the fore as a complaint about what you did to these actual human beings who you've shoved into detention. As you noted, the South Korean government is supposed to be arranging investments, additional investments under the trade deal with the U.S., somewhere around $350 billion of investment, new investment in the U.S. over the next 10 years. It's kind of hard to do that when the United States government is right. Telling you basically that any of your nationals who come into this country, we're going to slap them in irons and throw them in a fucking detention camp. Too bad. It's kind of hard to get anybody to want to come over here. Already, I think LG is seeing its workers, its temporary workers in the U.S. like heading for the exits before they get similar treatment. So, yeah, it's really kind of a shooting oneself in the foot thing, if you will, from the perspective. I know we're zealously trying to deal with all the foreigners who are in the United States, but sometimes they're here on more or less legitimate reasons, even if the in a technical sense, maybe they've stayed for an extra day or two. So it's something that will undoubtedly have impacts, not just on South Korean investment, but on investment broadly, I would think, as other companies and other countries have to look at this and say, you know, gee whiz, maybe we don't want to put our people at risk of being thrown into immigration detention because we're trying to do business in the United States. Maybe it's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly you're going to see companies come to that realization. And I would argue it's already not worth it. Just don't come here. There's nothing you need here that you can't get somewhere else with much less risk.
I mean, really good burger. You can get really good burger in America.
You can get good burgers. You can get like Wagyu burgers, man. I mean, Japan, you can get good burgers. Lots of places now.
Damn, you're right. I get it. Wagyu, I mean, I know what Wagyu you mean. Wagyu beef is not from America.
You know, I when I was working in the Middle East, I used to studiously avoid having any burgers while I was there, and I would crave a burger when I got back to the U.S. But you can still get decent burgers elsewhere.
Damn, tough news for American prestige. Yeah. The concept, I mean, not the show.
You know, you can't get like you can't get high fructose syrup as readily in other places. So maybe, you know, carry a bottle of that around with you if you're really really craving it.
Making me feel patriotic. all right, let's move on here to Mali. JNIM, the militia, is blockading. Is it fuel to western regions of the country, or is it a wider blockade? What's going on here?
So JNIM, Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam al-Muslimin, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadist group that's been plaguing Mali for quite some time now, has basically blockaded the western and parts of the southern part of Mali. In particular, it seized a couple of important towns near the borders with Senegal and Mauritania, and it now appears to be controlling an important roadway that comes through that part of the country, the Kayes Road. And through that, it's able to blockade Bamako, which is quite a ways away from this region, the capital of Mali. It's more in the central part of the country. But the fuel, a lot of the fuel that comes into Bamako comes along this road, And so J&M, having seized these places, now says that it's blockading fuel in particular. But there are other goods certainly that pass along this road as well, that it's blockading these things from getting into Bamako. J&M has been pressuring the Malian capital for, at this point, I think, years. So this is just its latest effort to squeeze the Malian government, such as it is, the junta, and the population of the capital to you know, kind of further its aims, which seem to be territorial in nature to some degree. Unlike Islamic State, it's not just out there, you know, kind of killing people for killing's sake, but it you know, actually does seem to have some designs on establishing itself as a governing force in the regions that it controls, certainly to the detriment of the people living there. But you know, still, this is a development that I think bears watching, because they can really kind of, and then I wouldn't say they're at the point of besieging Bamako, but they're getting there. The more that they are able to kind of cut off these main arteries into the city.
Jeez. All right. Well, I know, Derek, you will keep your eyes on that. While we're talking fragile states, let's move to France.
yeah, really borderline at this point.
Yeah, right.
Another country that's just cycling through leaders. You know,
yeah.
Well, the only constant is Emmanuel Macron and his, you know, 7% approval rating at this point.
Well, good hair, bad approval rating.
Yeah.
Exactly. What's going on? The French government is like effectively collapsed.
It's fallen. They held a no confidence vote in Parliament on Monday, and it was just overwhelming. It was 364-194 in the National Assembly to oust Prime Minister Francois Bayrou and his cabinet. Bayrou had called for this no confidence vote for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, over his plan to install or to introduce a very austerity friendly 2026 budget. And I guess this was supposed to be a challenge to the right and the left in Parliament, neither group, you know, wanting to work with Bayrou, who's kind of center-right coalition is a minority in Parliament. So he's dependent on those blocks, at any rate, to pass anything, certainly to pass next year's budget. And so this was sort of throwing the gauntlet down and saying, are you going to, you know, would you be willing to get rid of me and collapse the government? And they said, yes, in fact, we would. And so they voted to oust him. And neither, you know, he met with leaders of the National Rally. He met with leaders of the Socialists. And neither group was willing to back his austerity budget. So he's gone. And Macron moved very quickly. Unlike, you know, well, he moved fairly quickly last, kind of late last year, when his previous prime minister, Michel Barnier, was also ousted in a no confidence vote over similar things, over his austerity plans and the budget. He moved lightning fast this time around to appoint a replacement. He appointed the defense minister, Sébastien Lecornu, appointed him as prime minister, and Lecornu took office on Wednesday to a rousing welcome by about 200,000 to 250,000 people. Estimates vary. Who protested around the country. They're calling themselves the Blocon Tout, or Block Everything movement. They are very opposed to Macron. They're very opposed now to Lecornu. They're upset that Macron didn't try to make some kind of accord with, this is somewhat surprising, having now being on his third prime minister in less than a year, that Macron didn't try to make some sort of compromise either with the Socialists, who are sort of on the center left, or the National Rally on the right, to appoint a government that actually had a parliamentary majority and could get something done. Instead, he very stubbornly stuck with his center right austerity fetishizing block and stuck with and appointed Lecornu. So the protesters seem to be unhappy about that. They made a pretty good showing on Wednesday. They're not at the size of the Yellow Vest movement, which you may recall from 2018, which was a huge protest movement, also angry over austerity and, you know, Macron's efforts to cut pensions and that sort of thing. But they started off fairly, I would think, auspiciously with the size that they evinced, and may grow from there. We'll have to see. In terms of the cabinet, Lecornu hasn't selected his ministers yet. He's supposed to meet with the various party leaders to try again to see if there's some room for compromise. The French government does need to pass a budget somehow for 2026, and they can impose it. There are parliamentary tricks that you can use to try to impose a budget, but that brings forward other, you know, opportunities to depose the government in a no confidence vote. So it's all very fraught at this point. There's some question as to whether the parties would be willing to oust another government this quickly. But this is a sort of critical situation, I think, at this point for Macron and company.
Well, it sounds like he can just keep pressing the austerity button and that'll do.
Yeah. I mean, it's going really well for him so far.
All right. Well, let's move over into our hemisphere, our glorious hemisphere. Friend of the pod, Jair Bolsonaro, is eagerly awaiting a decision from Brazil's Supreme Court about his, I guess, the case against him for the role and sort of the coup and a couple of years back. What's going on here?
Yeah, the court has been, you know, trying him on insurrection charges, more or less, or masterminding that attempted coup to prevent Lula from coming back to power. There's not much to say here at this point because the verdict isn't out yet. It will maybe have been issued by the time people listen to this. There are five judges, a five-judge panel from the Brazilian Supreme Court that have heard this case. They're each releasing their opinions kind of one by one. So far, three of the five judges have issued their opinions, and two of them have voted guilty. One of them has voted to acquit Bolsonaro and basically annul the whole proceeding. He's argued that there are procedural reasons why the court should not have heard this case or should not have heard it in the way that they did. So, you know, there's two judges left, and only one of them would be needed to vote to convict Bolsonaro for him to be convicted. As I say, I don't have very much else to say about this because there's no verdict. There is, you know, already speculation about how the United States might respond because, of course, Donald Trump loves him some Jair Bolsonaro. They're kindred spirits. The White House, the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, even went so far as to suggest that the U.S. could take military action earlier this week if Bolsonaro is convicted. I don't know that that's a real thing,
right.
But she did say that the president is unafraid to use the economic might and the military might of the United States to protect what she called free speech, which apparently includes attempted coups to try and keep your enemy from replacing you as president. So who knows? I mean, you know, there've been, obviously people in Brazil have taken this as a threat, on the part of the United States to invade Brazil and bust Bolsonaro out of jail. If it comes to that, I don't think that it would, actually get that far, but who knows? Certainly, we can expect probably more economic penalties. You know, Trump has, slapped, I think, 50% tariffs on Brazilian goods, which was entirely because of Bolsonaro. Like, the U.S. has a trade surplus with Brazil, so the whole logic behind the reciprocal tariff scheme doesn't really apply to Brazil, but he imposed these 50% tariffs anyway, entirely because he was mad about the prosecution of Jair Bolsonaro. There are U.S. military forces in the region, as we know. I think they're probably there more for the possibility of invading Venezuela than Brazil, but anything's possible. So you know, I wouldn't completely rule it out, but I think more likely you're going to see maybe that 50% tariff get jacked up to 100%. Who knows? Jesus. I mean, it could be anything at this point, but yes, the U.S. is definitely monitoring this and will likely do something if Bolsonaro is convicted.
Anything for our boy Jair.
That's right.
Hey, maybe he can like go the path of, if he gets convicted and has to serve time, he can do like the January 6th guys and like podcast from prison. and then you guys could have
lawn. I would imagine he'd be, you know, he'd be in minimum security. He can, right. he can have a pod. He can do whatever he wants, you know.
All right. I'll look
forward to stay in touch with the fans.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, yeah, you sort of alluded a little bit to some U.S. related news in the region. So let's turn our attention to our beautiful country. Before we look towards the whatever the hell's going on in the Caribbean and with Venezuela, I first want to talk about an important and bold piece of truth telling from the Trump administration. they have decided to tell everybody to call the Department of Defense the Department of War, which was the name of sort of the, I think, the army wing that used to wage war.
Correct.
In the during World War II. So correct.
Do you think that anybody in the administration knows that when you call it the Department of War, technically, if you go back in U.S. history, you're excluding the Navy from it? I doubt that they know that.
Oh, they do that to our beautiful sailors?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, you know, as they're, you know, out there bravely bombing,
blowing
speedboats in the Caribbean. Yeah. I mean, you know, what are we doing here? Calling it the Department of War. It's not really the Department of War. There's been no official name change. Right, Congress would have to vote to change the name of the department. But we are spending billions of dollars, apparently, to change the name on all the buildings and the stationery and all the official letterhead and so forth. So that's a great use of money. I mean, you know, I guess at least it's not going into another F-35. but, you know, I can think of a number of things that you could probably do with that cash that would be more useful, like lighting it on fire for people who, you know, maybe didn't make their heating bill last month. They could just stand in front of that in the winter and warm up. That would probably be more useful than the Department of War the thing that they're doing. They've decided that all of the problems that the United States has had militarily and foreign policy since 1949 can be chalked up to the name change. You know, I think there were probably other things that were going on in 1949 that the U.S. Changed U.S. foreign policy for the worst and changed the U.S. military for the worst. But who's to say? Maybe hard it to really think was of, just the name change.
Hard to think of any sort of civilizational cold type struggle.
Yeah, you know, any kind of major changes in geopolitics or America's place in the world that might have coincided with the name change. But who's to say, really?
Oh, well.
Who are we to judge?
That's one of the benefits of having a marketing genius leading our country.
That's right.
It's just the changes we need to fix things at the margins, and that'll change everything else. While we're talking about Trump, there was this, like, I feel like it's little noticed in the media story about and what went on and during Trump's efforts to negotiate or talk with North Korea around its potential like nuclear weapons. And this includes just like murking a bunch of fishermen. What is this?
It is really kind of wild. And I understand, I guess, why it didn't get a lot of attention, because it happened in 2019 and there's enough craziness happening right in the moment that people can't be bothered to think about the craziness that happened in 2019. But at the same time, U.S. Special Forces did just murder a bunch of people who were out collecting shellfish and you know, then moved on. This was, as you said, the New York Times reported this on Friday. It was a 2019 U.S. Navy SEAL operation that was supposed to plant a data collection eavesdropping device in North Korea, like a bulk, I assume some kind of bulk data collection thing to intercept Kim Jong-un's communications, among others, presumably. But the idea was, like, they have this diplomacy going on, and Trump and Kim are sort of broing out, you know, on multiple occasions. But they have this blind spot in terms of being able to monitor Kim's communications. So they wanted to get a device in place. They put SEAL Team 6, they tasked SEAL Team 6 with making an amphibious landing using submarines in North Korea to plant a device that would intercept these calls. Only, unfortunately for SEAL Team 6, and unfortunately for the North Korean people who stumbled upon it, after they had come ashore, a small boat filled with, I think, three North Koreans sailed over to, and you know, there's a lot of these details that still haven't been released, and certain none of it has been declassified. So the Times was relying on, you know, whatever sources it could find. But they happened upon the landing site, and they're sort of, you know, checking out, like, what's going on here? They're shining flashlights. And the SEALs, you know, having been discovered or about to be discovered, made the decision to blow away everybody who was in the boat and then puncture their lungs with combat knives and sink them into the ocean, sink their bodies into the ocean. To cover their tracks. And then, of course, they had to leave right away because they couldn't be sure if these people were a patrol of some kind that would bring, you know, more attention. So they had to get out. They couldn't plant the device. It turns out they were not, in fact, a security patrol. They were probably just three guys out collecting shellfish at night who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, again, it's something that happened 6 years ago at this point. And I understand why people don't have the bandwidth, I guess, right now to give this a lot of attention or a lot of emotional investment. But it is really, you know, in the annals of spoofs and goofs by U.S. Special Forces, it is up there, and certainly a disturbing incident, made more disturbing by the fact that the Trump administration just basically chose to break the law and never revealed this operation to Congress. It took the Biden administration in 2021 to brief selected members of Congress. They did not brief, brief widely, and they didn't declassify. They could have just made it public and said, you know, look at what these fucking idiots did.
Why wouldn't they declassify political opponents like military?
But this is the omerta of the security establishment, which includes, by the way, the New York Times, which even acknowledged in its piece that it was withholding details on the mission for fear that those details might affect future special operations and intelligence gathering missions.
Future anti-fisherman operations.
Yeah, exactly. In case the SEAL Team 6 wants to airhole a few more North Korean fishermen, the New York Times certainly doesn't want to stand in their way.
Right.
And so they are, they're taking great care not to do anything that might upset their future plans in that regard. So it is indicative, I think. If nothing else, if you take nothing else away from it, of the way that the whole institutional, U.S. state, including the, supposedly adversarial media, comes together to sort of, make sure that these things are protected and allowed to happen.
Very well said. Very well said. I mean, maybe the SEALs would have succeeded if the Department of Defense didn't have such a woke name.
Yeah, I mean, there might have been like a transgender person involved on some level, or like, a person of color, or like a woman, even like I don't know.
In 2025,
This was before, this was Trump won. Like, they weren't firing all those people on site without cause the way they've done in Trump 2. So anything's possible. You could have had some woke, bullshit get in here and wreck the whole thing. Exactly.
Woke surveillance equipment.
Yeah. I mean, right.
Yeah. Jesus, man. That is some dark, dark shit right there. Speaking of dark, dark shit, let's end on a classically dark note here. So we got some new details this week about the U.S. bombing this speedboat in the Caribbean. Nominally, they were said to be carrying drugs to the U.S., but we're getting more details both about sort of like what was happening right before the strike, and also we like double or triple tapped the boat. What is this?
Yeah, I mean, you say heading toward the U.S. So there's the story that has emerged around this attack was already, at the breaking point in terms of absurdity. The administration was claiming that 11 guys from Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang, had loaded some drugs onto a relatively small speedboat, go-fast boat, in the Southern Caribbean, and they were sailing it in the general direction of the U.S. coast. Well,
also known as
boats
north.
Of that size. Yeah, north. Right. Exactly. Like, there's no way that a boat like that has the range to actually get to the United States. And yet the claim was this boat posed an imminent threat to the United States of America that justified, given Trendaragua's new status as a so-called foreign terrorist organization, that this justified striking the boat instead of interdicting it or doing literally anything else, that they had no choice but to just bomb this thing. Well, now we've found out, and this is from reporting, I've seen The Intercept discuss this, I've seen The Wall Street Journal discuss this, that the boat actually turned around and was heading back to shore, and they kept striking it over and over again until they were sure that they had killed everyone on board. So it wasn't even... at the end of this, it wasn't even going in the direction of the United States. It wasn't even going north anymore, apparently. So even that falls apart. And at this point, I don't think it's reaching to say that this was just, they just murdered these people. I mean, they just murdered these people. They're civilians. There's no indication that they were military. Even if they were Trendaragua, that's a civilian criminal organization.
Right.
And we don't know that they were. We don't know that there were drugs on the boat. There's been no evidence offered for any of this. And even if they were, what happened was a summary execution of an alleged criminal group committing alleged crimes without any sort of due process, which again is murder. Mm-hmm. Like, you murdered these people. The administration has apparently submitted its, you know, paperwork to Congress, its war powers paperwork to Congress, and people have had the chance to review it. Legal experts have come away from that saying that there's really no, they can't find any legal justification for this strike, either in U.S. law or international law.
Are they invoking a certain AUMF? Like, is it the anti, is it the war on terror?
I don't know. I haven't seen anybody go into the weeds of like what legal authorities they're invoking. I mean, I think the foreign terrorist organization designation, whatever that comes under, but that seems to be what they're relying on here, is that Trendaragua is a terrorist group. And it's effectively, I mean, it's both a shocking escalation, but it's also the end of a road that we've been on for 24 years now. And come back to where what we talked about at the beginning, the anniversary of 9/11. This is the denouement. This is the point at which you've crafted a system where terrorists can be killed under any circumstance, and all the president has to do is kind of nod in the direction of a group and say, oh yeah, those guys are terrorists, and that's it. We've got the legal authority to wipe them out, and that really seems like something that we should have stopped, you know, 20 years ago, or 15 years ago, or 10 years ago, or any time in the past 24 years. But we've created that system, and we've turned the keys over to Donald Trump. And he's using it in exactly the way that you would expect, to just deem people to be evildoers, and the military then goes along with that and kills them. And that's a situation I think that should terrify pretty much everybody.
That's really well said, Derek. It's like not an aberration; it's a logical conclusion.
Yes, it's the unfortunate logical conclusion that you were hoping we would not come to, but we're there at this point, and I don't think there's any going back from it.
All righty. Well, I think that's it. I mean, I guess I would say to listeners not to get on a boat, whether you're in the East Asia or if you're in the Caribbean, it seems like.
I just don't get in any speedboats. Let's just say blanket. Don't get in a speedboat. Don't do it. Wherever you are, it doesn't matter. Who knows what satellite or somebody's going to be watching and decide that you've got smack on the boat, and they're gonna take you out. Just don't do it. It's not worth it. I know they're fun. It's fun to go fast on the water and everything. You get excited, but it's not worth the risk that you're going to be drone bombed. I do want to say by way of plug, we released the third episode of Welcome to the Crusades, the first Crusade, our series with the folks at the We're Not So Different podcast. We released that to everybody this week. If you haven't listened to it and you're interested in the Crusades or in that series, please check it out. We also did a Q&A for people who had purchased the series and listened to it that we've released for people who buy the series. So check that out, and I'm sure we'll have Jake will put a link in the show notes for people to buy the series if you're interested. And that's all I have, Alex. I know you may want to direct people to your own show and your own stuff.
Well, yeah, I'll add an extra plug for the series. I just listened to that app and it was really excellent. But for selfish plugs for me, yeah, I would love if you guys check out, the podcast I'm doing with Courtney Rawlings, or at the Quincy Institute. It's called Always at War, looking at America's, manifestly pretty terrible foreign policy. We have an episode out this week on why in the hell we have 750 military bases dotting the world and whether it makes us safer, which is the rationale. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. It just makes wars easier. But yeah, please check it out. Just look up Always at War wherever you listen to podcasts. Check us out on YouTube. And thanks again, Derek, for having me on.
Well, thank you for doing it. And thanks to everybody for listening. And until next time, I guess keep on rocking in the free world. Why not?
Peace.
Bye.